actually insane. Very well, then.
Alexander drained his wine glass, as if for courage.
Then Federalist electors must withdraw their support of Adams for president. If we must have an enemy at the head of the government, let it be one we can oppose and for whom we are not responsible, who will not involve our party in the disgrace of foolish and bad measures.
I dismissed this as merely hot talk. No one could prefer that Jacobin, Thomas Jefferson, even to an insane John Adams. And I said as much to my husband later that night, in the darkness of our bed. His exhausted sigh crossed the space between us.
Mayhaps it makes no matter who becomes president, because 4 years from now I don't expect to have a head still upon my shoulders, unless it is at the head of a victorious army.
December 1800, New York City. President Adams declared peace with France and dissolved the army. Too late to stave off his ignominious defeat at the polls. Nationwide, the presidential election was a tie. Not between Jefferson and Adams, whose erratic actions sealed his own fate, but a tie between Jefferson and Burr. The presidential candidate and the vice presidential candidate had, through a quirk of our system, received the same number of electoral votes. But the people plainly meant for Jefferson to be president, and wished that Burr would simply accept the vice presidency as intended. I hoped for something else altogether. Because popular reason doesn't always know how to act right, nor does it always act right when it knows. Fortunately, the choice would be thrown to the House of Representatives, where my husband's Federalists reigned. Alexander would choose our new president. And in this, I sensed our salvation. Nearly laughing at the absurdity of Burr as president, I nevertheless felt a glorious relief. Burr was a trickster and a maker of chaos, to be sure. But he was also a man we knew well. Burr might be a libertine, but he wasn't a chilly zealot like Jefferson, musing about the desolation of the earth in the pursuit of liberty. In Burr, I felt certain we were to be delivered from our worst Jacobin nightmare of Jefferson unleashing the French Revolution on our shores.
So I was both stunned and dismayed to find myself in a heated argument about it when I passed by Alexander's study and overheard him telling our eldest son,
"Upon every virtuous and prudent calculation, Jefferson is to be preferred over Burr."
Philip and I both gasped at the same time. "Jefferson?" Alexander scarcely looked up from his writing table. Perhaps he dared not look at us, for fear he'd lose his nerve or his lunch. Rubbing at his kidney, which had troubled him recently with spasms, he said,
"There is no fair reason to suppose Jefferson capable of being corrupted, whereas Burr is bankrupt beyond redemption. His private character is not defended even by his most partial friends."
That Burr was corruptible, I had no doubt. Everyone knew he was in debt. "That only means he can be bought," I said. "And a man who can be bought can be bargained with." Now my husband did look at me, his eyes widening as if I'd sprouted two heads.
I suppose he looked to me for moral direction only to find that I, too, had been compromised by this wicked world.
"This is no time for saints, Alexander."
He shook his head and gathered his papers. "Nevertheless, Burr cannot be bargained with, because no agreement with him could ever be relied upon."
Shamelessly, I blocked his exit. "Even so, you cannot prefer a radical theorist like Jefferson to Burr, a mere opportunist."
"Is it a recommendation to have no theory?" Alexander asked. "Can a man be an able statesman who has none? I believe not. Burr is far more cunning than wise, far more dexterous than able. In my opinion, he is inferior in real ability to Jefferson."
"As if ability matters," I argued in frank disbelief.
As if these were ordinary times and not ones in which you tell me you stand to lose your head. It was exactly the wrong thing to say, and I realized it even before my husband stiffened. I shouldn't have appealed to his sense of self-preservation over the good of the nation. I was speaking, after all, to a man who'd been willing to fight and die for it. And I'd just questioned his willingness to do just that in the presence of our proud, patriotic son. Fortunately, and to my surprise, Philip was on my side.
"Father, the country won't survive, Mr. Jefferson."
Alexander held up his hands to fend us both off.
"I'm not an apologist for Jefferson. His politics are tinctured with fanaticism, and he's a contemptible hypocrite. But he's vain. He isn't zealot enough to do anything that will destroy his popularity or our union. By contrast, Burr will disturb our institutions to secure permanent power and wealth. He's an American Catiline."
Catiline, another accursed old Roman who'd plotted to overthrow the Republic. I remembered perfectly well a time when Burr jested that the Constitution was nothing but a miserable paper machine. But I said, "You're allowing your resentments to get the better of your reason." After all, though Jefferson always seemed to loom large, he'd been gone from our daily lives a long time, whereas Alexander had more recently tangled with Burr, been embarrassed by Burr, and been bested by Burr. My husband was too proud now to let Burr win, but I was not that proud. Give Burr what he wants, and you might win him to the Federalist point of view.
"A groundless hope," said my husband. "No, Burr is one of the worst men in the community. Sanguine enough to hope everything, daring enough to try everything, and wicked enough to scruple nothing. From the elevation of this man, may heaven preserve us."
Philip and I remained in mutinous disagreement. In fact, the argument in our household went on almost as long as it did in Congress, through 35 rounds of ballots. And while Congress debated, so did we. Upon waking and sleeping, at breakfast and dinner, before church and after church. And never in my life did I see anyone hector Alexander more relentlessly or effectively than my son did that winter. While I sliced bread for the younger boys one morning after prayers, Philip argued, "By denying Jefferson the presidency and throwing support to Burr, we could split the Republican vote in the next election. The Federalists must support Burr." Alexander might have made it out the door if he could have resisted an argument, but of course he couldn't. Another father, perhaps any other father, might have resented Philip's arguments as the insolent yappings of a young pup. But Alexander was proud of our son's political passion, and afforded him the same respect he'd give any other man in a political argument. That is to say, he went on at length, ruthlessly smashing every argument Philip made, as if they were no more than a swarm of buzzing gnats.
"There is no circumstance," Alexander concluded, "not in the entire course of our political affairs that has given me so much pain as the mere idea that Mr. Burr might be elevated to the presidency by the means of the Federalists. Jefferson is by far not so dangerous a man, and he has at least pretensions to character. Let the people have their choice."
With this, Alexander looked to me, as if to applaud the superior merit of his argument. But I thought Philip had the right of it. That's why I said, "We know Burr. He isn't the sort of cold-blooded man who would murder his political enemies." Oh, how it chills me now to remember the way Alexander replied, "He is precisely that cold-blooded." Part 4. The War for History. Chapter 32. Spring, 1801. Harlem. In a little rowboat upon the Hudson, the rising tide pushed us away from our old life toward the site of our new home, our place of respite,
and of our exile. For Jefferson was the president, and there was nothing to do but survive the outcome. Alexander was never able to convince me, Philip, or his Federalist Party that Jefferson was for the best, but he'd managed to convince a single elector from Delaware to switch his vote, and that had been enough. I could only hope his gamble paid off, especially since Martha Washington called Jefferson's election the greatest misfortune our nation has ever experienced. But since my husband had helped him win the election, we were cautiously optimistic that Jefferson would not seek reprisals against us for my husband's long and vociferous political opposition. "There it is," Alexander said as he rowed us to shore, his eyes shielded from the sun by a straw hat that looked nearly comical atop his general's head. He nodded at a bucolic spot on a forested hilltop. I looked up, a glint of sunlight off the dark green water momentarily blinding me. Then I saw it. Our new home upon this river along which I'd lived so much of my life. But unlike the pastures, or the little house at De Peyster's Point, or our rented townhouses, this home was ours. 35 acres. Barns, sheds, stables, gardens, orchards, chicken houses, duck ponds, and all. The existing little farmhouse was to be replaced by a much grander mansion that my husband wished to call the Grange, after the lands of his supposed noble ancestor in Scotland. And Alexander was trying to turn a mind long attuned to the architecture of government to the simpler architecture of a house. "What say you about black marble for our fireplaces?" As we floated pleasantly along the muddy shoreline, alone together for the first time in a while, I smiled. "I say, marble will be beautiful but expensive."
"I'll take on new clients," he replied. "Besides, your father is giving me timber. And what price is too great to pay for pure and unalloyed happiness with my excellent wife and sweet children?"
I wasn't sure my husband could be happy away from the bustle of the city, where all the most important decisions were made. But now that Jefferson's Jacobins had come to power, and my husband had decided to start a newspaper to point out their follies, it behooved us to get some small distance away from the inevitable riots and enraged mobs. "I think I prefer white," I decided. "Italian marble. Roman, if you will."
"Then you will have it."
He laughed, leaning forward so that our knees touched inside the little dinghy.
"For it has always been my creed that a lady's pleasure is of more importance than a gentleman's."
And thereupon we lost an hour to conduct that surely scandalized the fishes. Having run our little boat aground, Alexander laced up his breeches. Where his hat went, we didn't know or care.
"If this is how we're to spend our days in the country," he said, "I believe I shall quite enjoy the leisurely life of a gentleman farmer."
Rearranging my petticoats, all soaked with river water at the hem, I blushed like a girl half my age. You won't think it so leisurely when you must plow a field or feed the animals and slaughter pigs for dinner. There are no patisseries or coffee houses for miles.
"Ah, my belle of the frontier," he teased. "I shall have to take instruction from you. For I am as unfit for my new role as a country farmer as Jefferson is to guide the helm of the United States."
"Then perhaps you shouldn't have handed him the presidency," I wanted to say, but I was in far too good a humor to spoil the moment. So instead I said, "It's peaceful here. It will be good for the children, especially Anna." Our daughter never fully recovered from the loss of Fanny from our household. She'd seem better for a time, but lapse again into strange tempers. My husband tried to assure me this was quite normal for a girl of 16, and having been a girl of 16, I saw his point. "Perhaps here in the country she can have a pet." "What's wrong with our hunting dog?"
Hamilton asked. "She's your dog. Anna needs something pretty to cuddle. Perhaps a ginger tomcat," I said, playfully ruffling his hair, which was much less ginger now. "Mine did wonders for me." He gaped, as if both simultaneously offended that I should liken him to a pet, and also marveling that I could jest about such a thing. But we'd come far enough that I could.
"I worry more for Philip," my husband said.
"Philip?"
Our eldest was the only one of our children I didn't worry about. He'd grown from a sunny child into a charming young man of 19, who could talk his way out of nearly anything, just like his father. "If he wants a career in the law, he needs to more seriously apply himself to his studies," Alexander grumbled, like a curmudgeon, "without the distractions of the city."
Without the young ladies of the city, I thought, and nearly laughed. But my husband added,
"I don't entirely approve of his friends. I think they're gamblers and hooligans and mischief makers."
"At least they're not Republicans," I said. That broke the clouds over my husband's brow as he chuckled. In the days and weeks that followed Jefferson's inauguration, we settled into the farmhouse at the Grange. And Alexander did take more clients, which meant traveling, during the week, at least 3 hours a day to his office in Lower Manhattan. Then there were the trips to court in Poughkeepsie. And I was reminded of our early marriage, when he was so often gone with the city's gaggle of young lawyers, riding in stagecoaches with circuit judges. While packing his satchel for a journey upstate, he said,
"Don't overtax yourself with the garden or with getting cedar shingles upon the ice house."
Grabbing up his hat, then remembering his coat, he added,
"Leave to Philip what you cannot accomplish yourself."
Poor Philip. More comfortable in velvet coat, tailored trousers, and starched shirt collar turned up fashionably around his cravat, than he was in a hunter's shirt and breeches, he preferred life in the city, studying his law books and debating politics with his friends in the taverns. But Philip understood how important it was that we embrace our new situation with good cheer, so he didn't balk at working on the farm with his younger brothers. I wished I could have said the same for Anna, who complained that the farmhouse was too dark, too crowded, and the night she heard the howl of a wolf, she whimpered with fright as if she were a much younger child. For a wolf to cause such fright. At her age, I was more terrified of Mohawk scalping parties. Her fears kept her inside, laboring beside me in the sooty old kitchen. At least until her father came into the kitchen, satchel in hand, making ready to kiss us goodbye. "Why must you always go away?" she cried, storming out of the room and up the stairs. The slam of her door shook the whole house. Kissing my cheek, Alexander sighed and spoke as if he'd read my mind.
"Don't worry. She'll adapt to the circumstances."
I wasn't so certain, but just then the welfare of another member of my family weighed on my mind. "Are you sure it isn't too much trouble to visit Peggy?" Though my younger sister insisted she was just tired, she'd been feeling poorly for months, so Alexander made a point of frequently dropping in at her manor north of Albany, where he attended to his cases at the court. He shook his head.
"Of course not, it's on the way, and I'll take her the basket of crabs the boys hauled out of the river."
I walked with my husband out onto the porch, where our eldest son had the little phaeton hitched to a horse. "Seeing you will cheer Peggy, I'm sure."
"Perhaps, then, I'll even roast the crabs for her, though, as a Creole, I've some sympathy for them."
Alexander hefted the crustaceans onto the bench seat, just as little William bolted out the door and leaped off the porch, shoeless and shirtless. As my husband swung our 4-year-old ruffian into his arms, I couldn't help but muse that Alexander being able to refer to himself as a Creole, the word for the mixed-race people who sometimes subsisted upon shellfish on the islands where he'd been raised, was what had persuaded me that my husband had somehow, finally,
made peace with his dubious origins. And with our whole life now. For Alexander would never before have made such a jest. We'd both come quite a long way together indeed.
"Can I go with you, Papa?"
William asked.
"Not this time, little man," Alexander said, pressing a big wet kiss to the boy's neck that made him giggle. "But what if I bring something back for you?"
"A bow and arrows?"
William asked, clambering down with a little war whoop. I shook my head in exasperation, for our youngest son was endlessly fascinated by stories of the Indians and the frontier. I supposed it was the Schuyler in him. Chuckling, Alexander climbed into the phaeton and grasped the reins.
"How about I surprise you?"
Grinning at our son's excitement, I hugged him to me and waved in fond farewell.
"Give my love to Peg, and tell her to write."
Alas, I never received another letter from Peggy again.
"My dear Eliza, your sister took leave of her sufferings and friends, I trust, to find repose and happiness in a better country. I long to come home to console you and comfort you.
Alexander Hamilton." The blow fell upon me like a hammer to an ox. How could Peggy, who lived so bold a life, have succumbed so suddenly to some ignominious and unnamed disease? Though I had four sisters, I'd come of age with only two, Angelica and Peggy. From my earliest memory, I was the one in the middle, my older sister on one side, my younger sister on the other. Now Peggy was gone at just 42, and Angelica and I came all unmoored. On our knees in Trinity Church, we were bid by Bishop Moore to leave off our tears and remember the duty of Christian resignation. God had seen fit to take Peggy from us, calling her to a realm of bliss, and we must be happy for her. But Angelica and I indulged in our tears anyway. And we clung to each other even tighter when, not long after, Papa wrote that Mama, just a few months shy of her 70th birthday, had passed peacefully in her sleep. The woman who'd taught me about medicine and housekeeping and Dutch traditions, who'd helped birth my children, gone. Poor Mama. It was almost more than Angelica and I could bear, losing them both in such quick succession. But the fire of it forged us even closer. And in the months that followed, Angelica and I became constant companions. She made the 3-hour-long round trip through woods and farmland to see me at the Grange, complaining only a little that I'd fled the city. And I returned her visits with bumpy carriage rides to her house downtown. On one such visit to Lower Manhattan, we were treated to a noisy 4th of July celebration, during which an insolent young pup named Captain George Eaker told the crowd that President Jefferson had rescued the Constitution from my husband, who would have used his army to overthrow it. Much accustomed to such rabble-rousing abuse, Alexander and I merely continued on to our own celebrations amongst the Society of the Cincinnati, of which my husband had become president. But Philip could scarcely contain himself. That night, after playing billiards on his Uncle Church's new game table, he exploded.
"Do those mongrels realize my father gave Jefferson the presidency? They should be tarred and feathered for spreading such lies."
"Our son is apt to be a little intemperate," Alexander later complained. A complaint I took for the richest irony.
"There's no help for it, I'm afraid."
From behind his new spectacles, my husband arched a brow.
"Because I'm his father?"
"And because I'm his mother. His Schuyler blood will out." I remembered, after all, a time when I was just as angry on my own father's behalf, wishing to defend him against malicious lies and conspiracies. So, the next morning, I reassured Philip that patience was the best thing. "Just as your grandpapa was eventually seen for the patriot he is,
so will your father be appreciated and vindicated in the fullness of time. Then I forgot the matter entirely, because abuses and slanders had been too numerous in our lives to hold on to each one. Before the weather turned to winter, Angelica and I accepted an invitation to play a game of Pall Mall with Kitty Livingston upon her new husband's lawn. After vanquishing the other ladies with mallet and ball, not to mention haranguing them for donations, I retreated to a red velvet-covered divan in a corner where my sister and I could enjoy our tea with a little privacy. Perhaps because the loss of Peggy and Mama still felt so recent to us, we commiserated over the trouble we'd given Mama, something we understood with greater clarity now that we both had grown children of our own. And we reminisced about how Peggy had somehow convinced General Burgoyne to make a present to her of his shiny shoe buckles, how she'd fended off a hatchet-wielding Tory, and how she'd run off to marry the man of her heart. Of course, that was no mark of distinction in our family. In fact, elopement was an epidemic in Papa's household. Our little sister Cornelia ran off with a beau a few years prior, and now our little Katie, the very baby sister Peggy had rescued from the tomahawk-wielding loyalists, was threatening to do the same. "I've always set the trends," Angelica said, sniffling into her kerchief. "My dear Eliza, you were the only one unfashionable enough to do everything properly." "Poor Papa," I replied. "He has only one unmarried daughter left, and I predict she'll run off with her beau the first chance she gets." Balancing her teacup, Angelica whispered, "Poor us, if it's in Schuyler blood. Given her gaggle of suitors, Church is forced to keep his eye on our eldest daughter every moment. Meanwhile, I scowl disapprovingly at every penniless Jacobin who looks her way." "Are there any Federalist boys left?" I asked, for my husband's political party had crumbled in the wake of the election, and what they consider to be Alexander's unpardonable role in helping Jefferson win. "Are only yours and mine still standing?" "Well, I dare say there will soon be more little Federalists. Given the scandalous behavior of the girls at the last dance I attended, there's not a young lady in New York who wouldn't run away with your Philip or mine." The realization that my son was old enough to marry, and to sire children, was still somehow astonishing. Almost as astonishing as hearing Angelica speak about anyone else's scandalous behavior. How did we become the disapproving matrons, clucking our tongues at the edges of a dance hall? "Advancing age," Angelica scowled. "It's an appalling condition." I smiled over the rim of my teacup. "I don't feel so very advanced in age. Because you won a vicious game of Pall Mall? Well, you've always had remarkable stamina, but I'm soon to add another little one to the family," I said, splaying my fingers lightly over my bodice with excitement. "Another?" Angelica cried in equal parts delight and dismay. "It's the turn of the century. Have neither you nor Hamilton discovered French letters?" I smirked. "Well, you know how Hamilton distrusts all things French." My sister quite nearly howled. "You, Jezebel!" "Oh, hush," I said, because I didn't want her lady friends to overhear. So I leaned forward to confide, "If it's a girl, we'll name her after Peggy." "Peggy," Angelica said, her eyes misting with emotion. "How lovely." Together we melted over that sweet notion, only to be interrupted by a commotion at the door. The wife of my husband's law partner, Mrs. Pendleton, had arrived, apparently uninvited, without a coat or hat. She appeared in some disarray, insisting that she must see Angelica straight away. As we rose to greet her, Mrs. Pendleton literally trembled. "Mrs. Church, there is some manner of pandemonium at your house. You had better come quick. A young man has been shot and carried there, and a doctor called for. I fear..." My heart leaped to my throat, because I knew just what she feared, that my sister's boy had been shot. Angelica obviously feared it too, clutching at my hand and trying to remain upright. As Kitty swiftly gathered up our hats and handbags for us, I urged my sister to calm. I had, after all, treated many men in the war who survived gunshot wounds. Then I hurried my very pale and shaking sister to her house, where carriages blocked the drive. It seemed as if half the city's doctors crowded the entryway, with, to my surprise, my nephew apparently unharmed. Angelica flew to him. "Oh, you infernal boy! I feared you'd taken part in an affair of honor."
"No," Flip said, ashen as he looked my way. "It's my cousin."
In that moment, someone steadied me. I think it was my brother-in-law, murmuring some explanation. But the only thing I understood was that it wasn't my sister's boy who'd been shot. It was mine. How did I make my way to the gilded guest room in which my eldest son writhed? I don't recall. My only fixed memory is crashing through the door to find Philip, his pale neck spattered in a veil of his own vivid red blood. Alexander was already there, holding our son's shoulders as Philip convulsed with pain. Though my husband tried to warn me away with a shake of his head, I cried my son's name as I rushed to tend him, pressing frantic kisses upon his hand.
"Don't worry, mother,"
Philip said, trying to muster a smile.
"It just hurts like the devil."
That attempt at levity cost him. His pulse raced, then ebbed beneath my lips. I hushed him, as the war nurse in me frantically searched for the wound. I pulled back bed covers to find the spot on his side where the doctors had already cut the clothing away. What I found nearly drove me to my knees. Dark blood, not bright red like the spatter on his face. Dark blood, not red. Dark blood. An inky Madeira. The bullet had passed through his side and lodged itself in his opposite arm. It was the arm that bled red. But from the torso oozed the dark blood, which meant the bullet had passed through some vital organ. There was no help for it. I'd seen soldiers suffer such wounds, and I knew, with horrifying clarity, that my son was dying. Philip must have known it too, because he whispered,
"I need you to know I tried to escape the duel."
He followed this with a gasping breath.
"And when I couldn't, I determined to take no man's life, but merely offer my own in preservation of honor."
He grimaced again, writhing in pain, and Alexander shushed him with straining, halting words.
"Oh, my dear boy, save your strength. We could never doubt your honor."
I'd only heard that tone in my husband's voice one time before, when we lost our little baby, dead before she was born, which meant he, too, knew it was happening again. Now. Meanwhile, Philip was determined that we know he behaved bravely.
"I reserved my fire to throw in the air."
A duel. He'd fought a duel, and he'd thrown away his shot. It was all sinking in, and I didn't care. Dear God, I didn't care for anything but keeping him alive, and I hadn't the faintest notion how to do it. "Doctor," I cried, "he must have laudanum." Alexander reached to still me, and our fingers tangled, sticky with our son's warm blood, as he drew my attention to the bottle at the side of the bed. Philip had been dosed with it already. Any more, and perhaps we would hasten the end. I recoiled from the thought, though my desperate mind would later fasten upon the notion as some manner of mercy when our poor boy lay hour after hour, pale and languid, his rolling eyes darting forth through flashes of delirium. Caring not for the blood, we climbed into bed with him, Alexander on one side, me on the other, and whispered tearful words of love and comfort as the darkness fell. My sweet son, I said, in a voice I normally reserved for the littlest children. You cannot remember the happiness you gave us when you were a baby, but oh, the joy we felt, just to hold you between us in bed, just like this. Philip pressed his head against mine, and in my mind's eye, he was still the little jester who'd made us laugh, the brave 11-year-old who'd saved all my other children, the fiery 13-year-old who'd defended his father in the streets. And I wanted to know who did this to him. What fiendish murderer could have pointed a pistol at my beautiful, sweet boy? I had so many questions, but they would have to wait. For as Philip groaned in desperate pain, I realized my duty to him. I was his mother. I'd nourished him, baptized him, taught him, clothed him, and watched him grow into a man. And yet, he needed me still. Now, the most important, the most sacred thing that I could do for my son was deliver him from this world just as I'd delivered him into it. You mustn't be afraid, I whispered. These pains will soon pass. They will pass, and you will find your rest with God. Alexander tried to swallow a moan but couldn't hold it back. But Philip nodded, his blue-tinged lips trembling. I have faith in the Lord, and my conscience is clean. He closed his eyes, already more gone from the world than still in it. So I met my husband's gaze across the expiring body of our son, and met eyes so full of agony that I had to look away. Before dawn, Philip roused himself. What shall I tell Aunt Peggy when I see her in heaven? I think she'll be angry to see me so soon. Philip said this last part with a little laugh that brought a fresh cycle of convulsions. Don't laugh, my sweet, I told him, choking back a sob as I pressed my nose into his hair and inhaled the scent of him. Don't laugh if it hurts you. Alexander echoed me, his voice cracking. You always laughed too much. Your only fault, my dear boy. Philip tried to turn his grimace into a grin. Father, I shall debate you that laughter can be a fault.
And I shall let you win,
Alexander said, his voice a raw scrape.
A first,
my son whispered, closing his eyes with apparent relish. His breath rattled, then fell silent. Frightful, heartbreaking silence. That silence echoed through the room. I reeled from the bed, shaking my head, vehemently backing away in denial, nearly crashing into my sister's gilded chairs and mahogany tables. Half hysterical, half furious, I wanted to tear at my hair and beat my breasts and awaken myself from this cruel nightmare. But while I retreated, Alexander clutched our dead son, choking out,
Go, my boy. Go out of the reach of the seductions and calamities of a world full of folly, full of vice, full of danger.
All my life, I'd taken comfort from religion. But these words offered me no solace, and from my mouth came the keening of a wounded animal, a ghastly howl of despair. My cheeks streaked with salty tears, the skirt of my delicate pink dress stained with acrid blood and dried sweat. I was overcome with a desire to smash everything in my path. Silver mirrors, blue china, crystal wine glasses. To sweep off the elegant tables all my sister's goblets, candlesticks, and trinkets that held no worth in a world without Philip. But I was stopped by the sight of Alexander, hovering, shattered, over the deathbed of our boy. And the absurd thought that I couldn't endure to see one more thing broken. And because my husband was shattered, I couldn't endure to see him. Angelica tended me that night. She took the pins from my hair. She undid the fastenings of my police coat,
sliding the blood-stained embroidered cuffs off my arms. She stripped from me my stained pink dress. She bent down and removed my shoes and dosed me with the laudanum that was left. Where Hamilton slept that night, I did not know, but my sister put me into her own bed where the sweet, merciful oblivion of sleep overtook me. And from that dream state, where my son was still alive, I did not ever wish to wake.
Chapter 33. It was the will of heaven, said my well-meaning Christian lady friends. Remember the duty of Christian resignation. It was God, they said, who took my child from me. But upon my aching knees in a pew in Trinity Church, clutching my Bible, I knew better. It was not God who took my son from me. It was a Jeffersonian. Captain George Eaker, the violent Jacobin we saw ranting against my husband on the 4th of July. Having come across the man at a playhouse, my son and a friend had confronted him. Captain Eaker had grabbed my son by the collar and called him a rascal. Rascal. A word which, when spoken by one gentleman to another, demanded bloodshed.
Eliza,
Alexander now whispered, his hand upon my elbow, offering to help me rise. I startled to realize that we were alone in the church. How long I'd knelt in desperate prayer amidst wooden benches and the scent of incense, I didn't know. How long my husband had prayed beside me, I didn't know either. It seemed I didn't know anything. I'd been at the Grange while my son negotiated his affair of honor, blissfully unaware. But Alexander had been at his law office in the city. Still on my knees, I peered at him.
Did you know?
Hamilton swallowed and shook his head. He didn't need to be told what I was asking. Philip went to his uncle for advice.
And for those pistols,
I thought bitterly. Philip should have come to us. I'd made plain my Christian opposition to dueling. Every parson and priest in the country decried duels. Even Alexander had issued a memo to curb the practice when he was general of the army. But my son hadn't come to us. He'd gone to his rich, swaggering uncle with his shining dueling pistols and a reputation for deadly aim.
No, no, no,
I screamed inside my head. Bad enough that my son had involved himself in a duel that took his life. So much worse that he'd been the one to make the unholy challenge. I didn't have to ask why. Church, our family expert on dueling, would have told my son that he couldn't let an insult stand. Church would have told him he hadn't any choice when it came to honor. But what the devil did John Barker Church know about honor? He'd been born with it. He had the luxury as a young man to cast off a name and put it back on again as the circumstances suited him. He'd never had to scrape and claw to prove his worth. Not like my husband, who took my hand in his trembling one and tearfully said,
I learned of it only after Philip had issued the challenge.
I gasped. Then he had known. He'd known before the deed had been done. With desolate eyes, Alexander continued.
You must believe I tried to set him right. I told Philip it was ill-mannered to accost a man in the middle of a play and that he must apologize. I told him he wouldn't want this man's blood on his hands. I thought that would end the matter. I thought...
My husband's head dropped.
Next I heard, the apology hadn't been accepted and Philip was already rowing across the river to the dueling place. There was no time to do anything but race to find a doctor.
His voice broke off then, as if he could say no more, and yet he did.
Why couldn't I stop this from happening? I've stopped armies, but I couldn't stop a duel.
My anger ebbed at the sight of his anguish. In its place, regret and pity rushed in for a father unable to save his son. My husband had led troops, advised a president, and built a nation, but he'd been powerless in that moment when it mattered most. And now, from that prodigious mind, always spinning with plans and schemes, came an eerie vacancy. From that eloquent mouth, always arguing, proposing, and teasing, came a humbled silence. From those tireless hands, constantly scribbling out letters and essays and proposals, came only stillness. And so, together, we were both vacant, silent, and still. Our boy was dead. Dead for his own hubris, having initiated both a confrontation and a duel. I thought we'd taught him better. And it poured more sorrow into the bitter cup from which I was now forced to drink. All I had for consolation was the knowledge that he'd stood brave on that field, and that he hadn't taken a life. Instead, he'd let a villain shoot him so he could keep his honor. Never did I see a man so completely overwhelmed with grief as Hamilton has been. Robert Troup. Winter, 1801, Albany.
When is Philip coming home?
The question came in the middle of the night, spoken by my 17-year-old daughter with a lantern in her hand. Disoriented and blinking against sleep, I was actually convinced for a moment that we'd come to the pastures ahead of my eldest son, that he'd caught the next sloop and would be with us by dawn. Then the crushing reality overtook me with all its accompanying heartbreak. We'd buried Philip in the yard of Trinity Church, where, in dropping a handful of dirt onto our son's casket in farewell, Hamilton faltered and was kept upright only by our friends. That was weeks ago. Since then, Papa had sent a coach to fetch us to Albany where he might care for us himself. In truth, I think it eased his own grief in the loss of Mama to tend us in our grief for Philip. A grief which Papa, of course, shared, and as a father who himself had survived several of his children, one which he understood. But even as Alexander and I struggled to pull ourselves from bed and force small morsels of food down our throats, Anna now seemed to be caught in some blissful waking dream in which she believed Philip was still very much alive. Throwing the blankets aside, Alexander rose from the bed to embrace her.
"Philip has gone to heaven, my darling girl, a haven of eternal repose and felicity."
Anna's expression crumpled. "No, he's only gone riding just this morning. I made a pie for his breakfast. Remember?" She didn't know where we were. She didn't know when we were. She didn't remember that Philip was dead. Truly, she didn't. So for the next hour, she sat on our bed and asked question after question about how Philip died, her grief as fresh and raw as if she was reliving the nightmare. And we lived it all again with her, worrying for my health and that of our unborn baby. Alexander insisted I go back to sleep and led Anna out of the room. But I awakened to the sound of splashing water in the upstairs hall, my daughter singing with her Aunt Angelica. In coming with us to the pastures, my sister had left her own husband and children behind to offer comfort to mine. Now I found that Angelica had Anna in a copper tub and was brushing her hair as if she were still a very little girl. "You'll feel better soon, my darling, especially after a fresh, clean bath."
"But when is Philip coming home?"
Anna asked, and I put a hand to my mouth, grateful for my sister's help and wondering how many times I would have to remind my daughter that Philip was dead. Standing beside me, his face strongly stamped with grief, eyes downcast, as if staring into a bottomless pit of despair, my husband put a hand on my shoulder.
"Let her believe whatever she must. Her mind has become disordered by the wound. We must let it heal."
The disordering wasn't entirely new, or caused only by this wound. Now I saw Anna's distress when Fanny had been taken from us in a new light. The depth and intensity of my daughter's confusion was so much worse now than it was then. And in my grief and despair, it was terrifying. But because I felt as if my own mind had become disordered by the wound of Philip's loss, I could scarcely gainsay my husband. None of us would. My father, my beloved, devoted, kind father, tread as if upon the shells of eggs trying to comfort us. And my siblings followed his example. Only Angelica, over a melancholy Christmas breakfast, was brave enough to venture, "Do you not think we should summon a physician for Anna?"
"I'll not have my daughter locked up in an asylum,"
Alexander interrupted. He said this quietly but with such resounding authority it stunned us all into silence. Plainly stung by his tone, if not the injustice of the accusation, Angelica sat up straighter. "Why, my dear brother, I'm only suggesting that a doctor examine her." Alexander didn't answer, and his silence on the matter scared me more, for he was rarely silent on anything, and it meant he was scared too. Instead, he cared for Anna with saintly fortitude, singing with her at the piano and taking her for walks to watch for the birds she loved so well. But she got no better, and I feared my husband took too much pleasure sharing that fantasy in which she dwelt, where Philip was alive, rather than the reality we faced together without him. At the turn of the new year, I found Alexander in my father's blue parlor, the very place we married, with the same snowy view of the river. That day I'd been so hopeful, but it all seemed hopeless now.
"Are you certain we shouldn't send for the doctor?"
"They'll lock her away."
Hamilton folded his arms as he stared out at the frozen river. He seemed so very far from me, and his hair had turned snowy as if overnight.
"We won't permit it,"
I reassured him, confused by what seemed an irrational response from an otherwise rational man.
"We could choose a trusted doctor. Any you prefer. We could write to Dr. Stevens or Dr. Rush or..."
"They locked up my mother. I will never let it happen to Anna."
"They jailed your mother for adultery," I thought.
"Not a disordered mind." Why should he be so fearful? No one would do anything to Alexander Hamilton's daughter without his consent. He was no longer a helpless, penniless boy in the West Indies. He had commanded armies, a nation. He could protect his daughter. But perhaps he didn't believe it, because he hadn't been able to protect our son. And I didn't broach it again because I felt as if suspended on the thinnest ice, afraid to make the smallest misstep, lest we all should fall.
May the loss of one be compensated by another Philip. May his virtues emulate those which graced his brother, and may he be a comfort to his tender parents.
General Philip Schuyler to his daughter, Elizabeth Hamilton. June 1802. Harlem. Flowers again. Yellow daffodils, purple hyacinths, red tulips. Then pinkster azaleas when the weather turned warmer. In the days before and after little Phil's birth, my husband filled my room with a rainbow of blossoms. My new room, in the house he built for me at the Grange, with its delicate fanlight in the entryway, the extravagance of 8 fireplaces, and the mirrored doors of our octagonal dining room that could be thrown open to the parlor to form a rather grand ballroom. Though I couldn't imagine we might ever host a ball.
"We will, my angel,"
Alexander vowed, laying a bouquet of fiery lilies across the bed.
"That I promise, and a promise must never be broken."
He treated me now as if I were quite a fragile thing, as fragile as our newborn babe, as fragile as our poor, unfortunate daughter, whose mind remained disordered.
And oh, the money he spent trying to make us all happy again. He spared no expense in the marble Doric columns, verandas and bay windows, walnut side chairs, silver oil lamps, and gilded mirrors. Wages for Mr. and Mrs. Genty, the couple he hired to serve as our cook and housekeeper. Then there were books and smart suits for our boys, especially our auburn-haired Alex, who found himself now at 16, in the position of the eldest son with all its expectations. And there were little parakeets for Anna, who seemed to grow younger every day.
She only needs tenderness and attention, Alexander reassured me as we took a summer stroll together on the Sylvan grounds. She will recover in time.
And if she does not? I asked quietly. For a long moment, he didn't respond. So long that I feared he might not at all.
Then we will care for her here at the Grange, where she cannot be exposed to the cruelty of onlookers.
I nodded, for it was the thing I loved best about the Grange. It was far from prying eyes. It was a refuge. If ever we might be healed of our loss, it would be here. And yet, our boys must have their schooling. But how will Alex and James and—
I'll take them with me into the city during the week, Alexander said. I'll stay with them while you and Anna and the littlest ones remain here, so that none of them will ever be without one parent or another.
It would be a terrible sacrifice to be apart from my husband half the week, but I too feared for any of them to be alone. Alexander was with the children every day, sometimes even leading them in prayer. He'd never expressed any liturgical curiosity, but now he sought out the friendship of Reverend Mason, the Federalist pastor of the Scotch Presbyterian Church near our rented house on Cedar Street. And my husband prayed, before asleep and upon rising, scribbling notes into the margins of the Bible. So I was not surprised to hear him say,
"Someday I will build a chapel for the children, right here in our very own grove."
For him to come more fully to God had always been my hope. But there seemed to me something sinister in it now, as if, despairing of this world, he pined for another. And I remembered another time when my husband had cared for me, while hiding that he himself was falling to pieces. What I wanted now was for us to take care of one another. I didn't feel as if I could ever be compensated for the loss of my son. But with another babe at the breast, I felt powerfully reminded of the sacred obligations Alexander and I had undertaken in starting a family. Our children deserved from us a celebration of life. And so I said simply, "You must forgive yourself." My husband took a breath, as if my words had cut him, then glanced off at some fixed spot on the horizon.
Philip needed me, and yet I failed him as surely as my own father failed me.
No, you were his hero.
A hero?
Alexander laughed bitterly, pressing his back against the trunk of a tree, lost in a hell of self-recrimination.
I once fancied myself powerful. What has become of my arrogance now? How humble, how helpless, how contemptible I am. A vile worm, a presumptuous fool to offend God, whose nod alone was sufficient to crush us into pieces.
So he believed Philip's death to be some manner of divine punishment. No man or woman is righteous, Alexander. Not even one. A merciful God forgives. He doesn't visit the sins of the father upon the son. Alexander straightened up from the tree and walked for the fence, as if he meant to escape me, his torment, or both.
Our boy died defending my name.
Yes, he did. And I knew that at Philip's age, if I could have, I'd have done the same. I'd have dueled for my father's honor, too. Semper Fidelis. It was in our Schuyler blood. And it was the first, most important lesson I ever taught him. You gave him a name worth defending. a name in which to take pride and solace in the shape of his character. I said, reaching for my husband, you gave him that. You gave him what you never had, and you gave me your name too.